news alerts each day, you can text the word democracy now, one word, to 66866. Special thanks to our crew here at UC Santa Cruz Learning Technologies, John Radicke, Gary Gyorkos, Juan Perez, Chris Salerno, David Valadez, also former Democracy Now! Fellow, now UC Santa Cruz PhD student Juan Carlos Davila, Dennis Moynihan, and Mike Burke. Special thanks to David Shaw and Gene Fox as well. Happy birthday, Samin Fakande. Democracy Now! Is produced by Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Harla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Libby Rainey, and Nat Needham. Special thanks to Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Paul Huckabee, Julie Crosby, and Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
People are always looking to invest in a good opportunity. So what if you could invest in the future of kids, like a stock? Not the kind of stock that's about making money, but a stock for social change, called Better Futures. With your investment, it helps students like me go to college. My name is Charles, and I'm your dividend.
Invest in better futures with UNCF. Visit uncf.org/invest. A mind is a terrible thing to waste, but a wonderful thing to invest in. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Computer Information Systems Certificate in Web Technologies and Design.
Love to design stuff and play on the internet? Henry Ford College offers a one-year certificate program in web technologies and design. Advanced HTML, computer art, web authoring tools, and web multimedia are a few of the courses offered.
Computer Information Systems Certificate in Web Technologies and Design.
The program is designed to prepare a student to take CIW Certificate Internet Webmaster exams.
For more information on CIW exams, log on to www.ciwcertified.com.
Drop by the HFC Counseling Office or log on to the web at hfcc.edu.
Computer Information Systems Certificate in Web Technologies and Design.
Impact Fourth Tuesday. Every fourth Tuesday at 1 p.m., meet people who are about making a difference in your community. Our programs are designed to be a catalyst that helps nonprofits and other community organizations get the word out to you and help them to reach their goals and potential in serving others. Listen to Impact every fourth Tuesday at 1 p.m. and see who is making a difference.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views and opinions expressed on the new WHFR Journal are those of the hosts, producers, and guests, not necessarily those of WHFR, its licensee, Henry Ford College, or its Board of Trustees. Enjoy.
Welcome to this edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Susan McGraw, along with Alan Mazurek, who is suffering from a bit of a summer cold, which has gone into the chest area. Alan, I know you're doing the best you can, and I wish you well, and hope to hear from you at some point, maybe for today's show. But we're excited to be celebrating the spring season. The summer weather has kind of kicked in, and we want to talk about a couple of exciting things going on. One of them, the Dearborn Farmers and Artesian Market. They want to thank all of their customers and vendors for a wonderful 2017 season, and we want you to know that the market will be opening soon. So mark this on your calendar, starting June 1st and going through September the 28th. Every Friday, patrons will visit carefully selected vendors who sell only seasonal, local, Michigan-produced farm products and goods. There is a variety of vendors that will be on hand, including fresh flowers and produce, artisan baked goods, cheeses, meats, soaps, woodworking, pottery, and so much more. And when you shop at the market, you can enjoy special features like cooking demos, always my favorite, live entertainment, food, different trucks, gardening workshops, ice carving demonstrations, and even yoga sessions provided free by Yogashala. The farmers market is a great place for people of all ages. I go every year, and I'm sure if you can get into the area that you will too. Well, where is the the farmer's market. It is at the West Village Commons on Michigan Avenue, 22271 Michigan Avenue in Dearborn. And every single Friday, starting on June 1st, the event will be open. New hours this time around. And in addition, some extra little fun things going on throughout the farmer's market season. Again, it runs starting June 1st through September the 28th, and starting on June 1st, you will find the market itself starting at 2 p.m. until 7 p.m., so that's the kickoff, the official time frame for the market, 2 to 7 every Friday through the season. There will be some other activities on June 1st from 10 to 1, special activities, as well as some things, for example, movies in the commons. There will be some special cooking demos earlier in the day on different days of the week, Friday night music and foodie rallies, so much going on. So I am encouraging you to check out the website, Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market, and you can simply just type in Dearborn Farm Market if you like, and it will come up. Do want you to know that there is an opportunity to not only come and buy some stuff, but again, have some late lunch or even come in for dinner, because there is tons available to you. There are lots of things in the kids' tent this time around, with art lessons, games, face painting, and nutritional information. And also for senior citizens, there's some free blood pressure checks as well. Again, the market runs every Friday throughout the summer from 2 to 7. And if you want to know exactly where that location, I gave you the address there. The exact location in West Village Commons is really just behind the historic Bryant Library, right off of Michigan Avenue. So come to our weekly event in the heart of Dearborn for really a fun-filled day. And it's all about supporting local farms and local businesses. That's what the farmer's market really is all about, in addition to some just amazingly tasty food, some fun activities, etc. And there is a list of vendors that goes two pages deep, so I'm not going to go through the list. But as we move through the season, we hope to be telling you more about it. But check out the Dearborn Farmers and Artisan Market, and check out the website. You can find it through the City of Dearborn website as well, cityofdearborn.org. But looking forward to seeing you there, and maybe having some late lunch with you, right? We have more things on the way on this edition of the new WHFR Journal. I'm pretty sure we're going to hear from a TED Talk or two. Note that next week on our WHFR Journal show, it will not be the new part, but we will be incorporating lots of other opportunities to learn some stuff during the course of the weeks in spring and summer. But we will be going on a bit of a hiatus after next week's show. So lots of exciting things going on in spring and summer, and we need to be there as well, so we can't be in the studio for this particular show. But we're going to find some great stuff for you, but enjoy this edition of the show and next week's as well. And we look forward to continuing to stay in touch with you on local news and views right here on WHFR. Well, coming up in our first segment, Bob Burnham joins me, a local broadcaster, newly acclaimed WHFR staff member, and most importantly, he is an aficionado in old-time radio broadcasts. So we'll do a little reminiscing, a little bit of that vintage radio stuff coming up in just a little bit. This is the new WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here, and we encourage you to stay with us.
In 2014, 1 in 68 kids in the U.S. was diagnosed with autism. In 2016, it increased by 15% to 1 in 59. Diagnoses have come as early as 4 years old. Worst of all, about 50,000 teens with autism age out of school-based support programs every year. Autism Speaks has information on this and more. Log on to autismspeaks.org or call 888-288-4762. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen.
Young people everywhere are making a difference.
Special Olympics has changed my life so dramatically.
It's helped me a lot to be fearless, you know, in the real world.
My friends I've made through Special Olympics are the best people I've ever met in my life.
I truly realize that what I'm doing is for a great cause.
And it's not about disabilities, but it's about celebrating their abilities.
I've made a difference. Now it's your turn to make a difference.
Get involved at SpecialOlympics.org.
Please join WHFR.FM 89.3 for Blues Music on Highway 61, Friday 2 till 4 p.m.
Each week, DJ Kitty Love brings the best in new blues releases in Detroit blues to Henry Ford College Radio, WHFR.
This is the new WHFR Journal. My name is Susan McGraw. So much going on for the summer season. But boy, don't you miss those days when you could curl up at night in front of the radio and listen to some old classic radio mysteries or some drama or some exciting, crazy soap opera type thing that you only hear, that theater of the mind idea. I know I'm going a little crazy here, but the point is those old time radio shows are not dead and gone. They still exist, and there's a possibility that we might be getting them back here at WHFR. Here in studio joining me now is, to me, one of the most interesting men that I have ever known, honestly. His name is Bob Burnham, and he is connected with and owns BRC Productions, as well as has his hands in lots of different radio-related cooking capacities. And Bob is here to tell us a little bit about his experience with those old-time radio classics and also what we might be doing here at WHFR. You might recall we used to run the old-time radio mystery shows, those serials week after week on Thursday afternoons, and we're excited to kind of resurrect that concept. Can't do it without Bob. That's why he's here. So Bob Burnham, welcome to the studio.
How about that? Well, good to be here, and it should be a fun time, let's put it that way.
We think so too. You have been really sort of making this your mission to keep these old classic radio shows alive and available for people should they be interested in listening, both personally or professionally, and you know, in bigger sort of broadcast capacities. But how did you get your start in all of this? What led you to it?
Well, years ago I was interviewed by Knight Ritter, back when it was the Detroit Free Press, and they asked me, well, you know, you were born too late. These shows, you were not alive when these shows came on the air. But actually, I was back in the late 60s, early 70s. A local personality by the name of Warren Pierce used to rebroadcast these on the weekends. And I thought, wow, this is a lot better than what's on TV, which at the time was The Partridge Family and The Brady Bunch and shows that I wasn't interested in. And back in those days, families didn't have a TV in every room. They had like one television. So I started listening to these things on the weekend. And eventually I found an ad for a company by the name of Radio Yesteryear out of New York. And they were selling these things. They were very expensive. They were like $12 an hour. Wow. And I thought, well, let me see if I can scrape up the money. I'll order a few. And I did. And that was kind of the start of it. And one thing led to another. And I wanted more and more shows. And how do you pay for those shows when you're, you know, a teenager? So I started selling cassettes to my friends for a couple dollars a cassette. And that was the start of BRC, which is Bob's radio collection or Bob's recording company or whatever you want. Then I added the other thing after it. And I had to change it to BRC Broadcast because a country music singer by the name of Billy Ray Cyrus started a company of the same name. So I had to kind of rename myself. But that's kind of in a nutshell how I started.
Yeah. What is this mystery thing you speak of called a cassette, by the way?
A cassette is...
I mean, and I know, I'm teasing.
But, yes, I know. Yeah. A cassette is a little a miniature reel-to-reel. You had, in the old days, tape, which moved from left to right. And there was no such thing as digital recording, so we laid it out on a thin piece of plastic, and a cassette was an enclosure that had two miniature reel-to-reel spools in it. And that's how we recorded back in the 60s, 70s, and well into the 80s and 90s.
Mm, and you're speaking my language there. We have our little museum here in Studio B.
Yes, I've
at
been
WHFR.
Noticing. I was studying it.
Yeah, I'm looking at a reel-to-reel machine right there. I honestly have never really thought of
cassettes as mini reel-to-reels.
Yes.
It's so crazy how it's perfectly logical. But
it was invented by Norelco, the shaver company.
Wow, there you go. They have a lot in common, the two things, don't they? No, they don't. But anyway, well, that's fascinating. When you moved sort of into the now I'm a sort of a salesperson kind of a thing, what was the reception like? What kind of, you know, how did your friends and other people beyond that little inner circle take to this stuff? And, you know, what happened there?
Well, at first they liked it, and I started a little newsletter. And one of my friends would write a column in the newsletter about what he heard on the radio show. So for the most part, there was only a few close friends that were interested. And then after that, I discovered I needed to expand beyond the high school and whatever I was involved in on a day-to-day basis. So I placed ads in a bunch of stereo magazines. And even the Detroit News, I had ads in offering old-time radio on cassette. I hadn't moved into reel in the earliest days, but I did original. I did eventually, because that's where all the big collections were, is on reel-to-reel tapes.
Hmm. Interesting. Would you say, in general terms, not your collection necessarily, we'll talk about that in a minute, but in general terms, how many different of those types of radio shows exist out there? Because, I mean, I know people are like, oh, Suspense, oh, The Lone Ranger, oh, Johnny Dollar, that's it. That, you know, it's a ton more than that, isn't it?
Well, there's over 900 shows of Suspense alone existing.
Wow.
And over 500 Gunsmokes, and probably 400 or 500 Jack Benny's in the comedy vein. And there's people who specialize in these different shows, and they went and searched, and eventually they all kind of came together. And there's different archives around the country that have everything.
Wow.
If you know where they are.
Uh-huh. And that's the key, if you know where they are.
Yes.
I know that I bought some stuff for my dad. It was a TV, you know, some TV promotion thing. You could get some different shows, and they were fine. They were, you know, packaged nice, but just felt a little bit of like a superficial collection. You got some of the, like, going deep kind of stuff, don't you?
Yes, and there's people who go much deeper than me. There was a superintendent of schools who passed away a couple years ago, but he had, like, more than a quarter of a million shows stored on reel-to-reel tapes. And he was an easy guy to get along with. I traded with him when I was about 17. And I thought, wow, this is exciting. My first big trade with a big collective guy. And I eventually met him. And he was just, oh, you know, whatever you want, I'll send it to you.
Wow.
And I actually wrote a segment of a book that he wrote in later years about kids' westerns. So that was fun.
Yeah, it sounds fun. This is a creative area, but one that I think probably has a bit of like a niche audience, or at least one would think that it has a niche audience, because it's not that easy. You know, you might think this is the easiest thing, you just put it on at night before you go to bed, whatever. But I think it's an acquired taste to be able to connect with that concept, that sort of creative theater of the mind, where you can actually sort of see in your mind's eye what you're actually hearing. Is there
a lot of people are visually
that?
Oriented, and you know, those of us who've worked in radio aren't that way. However, it's kind of, you have to get a taste of it, and once you do, it becomes an addiction. Fortunately for me.
Yeah, that's right.
But you have to market the stuff. If people don't know it exists, then they're not going to come to you for more.
Yeah, and I hate to say it, in this day and age, we talk about a visual world with our younger people growing up with the screen. You know, there's a screen everywhere, not just the headphones, not just the radio part, but the visual screen is so dramatic. Do you have many of those young teenagers, kind of like what you did back in the day, that are starting to connect with this stuff?
There were a few back in the day who are now in their 30s and 40s who got addicted. And, you know, there's one guy in Massachusetts who orders like two or three CDs or cassettes a month, like clockwork. And I knew him again back when he was a teenager. Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of these people I met at conventions.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that, Bob. When the group gets together at a convention or a particular event, is it as wild and crazy as like a Comic Con kind of a thing, or is it pretty kind of low key? And do you bring in, I know like the comic conventions and things, some of the celebrities come in, but a lot of the people that are doing the voices and such are probably either pretty old or maybe have passed on.
Right. Well, I could tell you a little bit about how it developed in the 80s, since I was involved back then as well. And there were some of the celebrities around, and we had the biggest one in New Jersey. We had a handful of celebrities who would actually get some old scripts, and we would recreate the shows.
Wow.
And I was one of the guys who recorded it. But then in other rooms in the hotel, we would have people offering radio premiums, cassette CDs. We had an autograph room where the celebrities would have photos that they would sign for you. And that was the early days. Now it's kind of mellowed out. There's really only one convention left, and that's in the Baltimore area. And that's kind of the new place, but it's been expanded out to include old movies and early 50s TV shows.
Huh, that's interesting.
But there's still us old hardcore radio guys who show up at those things.
Yeah. Wow. Bob Burnham is joining me. He is the head of BRC Broadcast.
Yes.
And also very involved in local radio, has been for many years. And this whole thing related to old-time radio classic shows and every genre, I'm telling you, it's like amazing. You can find anything. But I want to ask you, Bob, as it sort of relates to the resurgence of this kind of stuff, it seemed like back in the day, we had some TV shows that were either spin-offs of the radio shows. I'm guessing it wasn't the other way around. Is there a possibility for something, you know, something like that again? Are there any shows, TV shows now that maybe we could do a radio show based on? Or, you know, I mean, I don't know. How does that work? How does
there,
that whole thing
there
work?
Probably is. I mean, there's a lot of the comedians who had shows on both mediums. Mm-hmm. And there was some detective shows that were on both mediums. The problem is that it's hard to recreate the theater of the mind for television, although CBS did it with Suspense for several years. Mm-hmm. But it also costs a lot more to do television than radio. But I think it has some possibilities.
When we talk about some of the popular ones these days, you mentioned a few different ones, different genre. Is there a best-selling show that you've experienced in your time doing this?
The best-selling comedy is Jack Benny. The best-selling mystery is Suspense. There's other really good shows like Escape that are out there, but for some reason people seem to gravitate toward tried and true Suspense, because there were so many. It was on for 20 years, and there's only a few of them missing from all those years.
Okay. Local radio broadcaster, legend Bob Allison. I know used to listen to our show when we would run the radio mysteries here at WHFR. And you and I go back to some other radio stations where we used to run these radio mysteries and so on.
Yep.
Is there anybody running them that you know of right now in the local area?
I don't think so. There was a series called Radio Spirits that was aired at midnight at one of the little suburban stations that we all know and love. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that show is on the air anymore. Warren Pierce is still on the air, but he's not playing old shows. I'm surprised he hasn't retired yet.
Well, we're glad that you haven't retired yet, because our goal here is to kind of bring back some of this stuff. And I'm going to ask our listeners who might have an interest in this to maybe shoot me an email or a call or something and let us know if you would like to see some of these old classic radio dramas, mysteries, comedies come back to our airwaves here at WHFR. We know we're primarily a music station. We do a little bit of talk, and obviously this show, the new WHFR WHFR Journal on Friday afternoons as one of those talk shows. But this is a little bit unique. It is, you know, it supports our mission, because our mission at WHFR is providing programming that's either not at all or little else heard on the Detroit radio dial, let alone the radio dial in general. So I think it's a great fit. But let me give you some contact information. My phone number, 313-845-9842. Again, 313-845-9842. I am a teacher on campus as well, so if you get my voicemail, if I'm not actually sitting at the desk answering, just leave any comments that you might have, or leave a time frame where I might be able to call you back with your phone number and so on. I'd be happy to do that. But, you know, what do you think about this? Would you like to hear your particular favorite show from back, is The Lone Ranger something that you haven't heard in ages and you'd like to hear it again, or who knows what else? Here's an email address as well, if you prefer the digital kind of thing, and it's SC McGraw, M-C-G-R-A-W, S-C McGraw, at HFCC, Henry Ford College Cares, .edu. Okay? So, you know, shoot us a line and let us know what you think. Bob, what's your particular favorite? I know probably people ask you that, and you're like, you don't want to pick, but I'll bet you have one deep down.
Well, it depends on what my mood is. I think Suspense is a very good show, but there's various time periods when the show wasn't so good, depending on who was involved. In the days when they had big movie stars, it wasn't always as good. But in the later days when they had people who knew how to do radio acting, which is different from regular acting, the shows were really good. So it's probably, for me, Suspense and Escape. And I don't like Westerns, but William Conrad on Gunsmoke is really good for character development. That's for that genre of radio. And for comedy, probably Jack Benny. Okay. You know, what, the classic cheapskate character.
So funny. What are some of the other comedies that you sell that you would say would be, also favorites?
Fibber McGee and Molly, George Burns and Gracie Allen. A famous one, although we don't like to talk about it too much today, was Amos and Andy. We kind of sidestepped that one for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There was a show that highlighted movies that ran for 20 years, Lux Radio Theater, and the list goes on. Scary shows, Inner Sanctum, The Hermit's Cave. Hermit's Cave was produced locally at WJR. And what else is there out there? That's kind of a tip of the iceberg.
No doubt about it. Well, we know that you have the resources, and you also have the backstory, which is always interesting. So
yes,
it's not just the show itself, but it's sort of what, you know, some of the little details that went into the creation, or some of the people that are starring in
right.
it and so on, which I think makes it so much more interesting. The context, I guess, is
right.
is what I'm saying. So
right.
So we hope to get you on the air here. We hope to get some of this stuff going, and we look for our listeners' input to tell us what they think, and what, you know, sort of vote for what you want to hear as we move this forward. It's exciting. Bob, if we have the option to bring this type of radio into sort of to the masses, is there something that would need to take place with the way our, you know, the way we're teaching our young people to think creatively, or some type of a way to get the information to them? We know satellite radio and cars is kind of big, but they're all on their phones, you know. So
yeah.
So what do we need to do?
Well, we kind of already have a head start on that with the fact that the station streams. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a good step in the right direction. And then, try to get them to do something to get them in the mood. Like, obviously, if it's a scary show, turn the lights down, you know. Go to bed and put the radio or the phone, whichever it may be, on in the background, like was done a generation ago. Just close your eyes and think.
Great. Very well put. Well, we're excited about this. So happy to have you here today. And I know you kind of jumped in on the spur of the moment. And thank you for being available to
That's
us.
That's what I do.
Oh, you're wonderful. Any big projects that you're working on? When is that convention, by the way, that you mentioned?
Well,
Baltimore?
Unfortunately, there was a convention here in Michigan that happened around this time. And it didn't go over too well a year ago. So they're not having another one this year, or they're just doing recreations with people in the Kalamazoo area. Mm. So that's not happening, but there is a convention coming up in September, I believe it is. And that's, I don't even remember the name of it, but it's the Nostalgia Convention in Huntsville, Maryland, headed by Martin Grams Jr., who's a great author of this stuff, and he's younger than you and I. So,
very nice.
It's good to, like I said, have some younger people helping to spread the word.
Yeah. I also think generational, it's exciting too. Like maybe grandpa can listen with grandson kind of a
thing, or whatever.
Just something nice to bond about and to leave as a legacy for the younger generations.
Of course.
So I know my dad did that with me, and I thought it was great. So anyway, we're glad to have you as always and look forward to having you on the air more often, Bob. If somebody wanted to contact you, they just want to chat about this stuff or they're looking for something, how can they reach you?
The best way is probably email, and it's pretty easy address. It's bob@brcbroadcast.com. That's it.
All right. Easy enough. Thank you for your time. Look forward to talking to you soon, and I hope you have a wonderful summer. Got some nice weather, so let's get out there and enjoy it.
It's about time.
All right. Thanks again. We have more on the way. This is the new WHFR Journal. Stay with us.
Good morning, everyone. This is Bill. I am the host of a show called The World Through Music. I would like to invite you to meet me every Monday morning at 12 o'clock as we travel the world. We travel different cities, different countries, and take you to places we couldn't go without the art of music. So join me, Bill, every Monday, 12 until 2, as we travel all the world by music.
Okay, so Sarah, I'm dropping you off at Emily's?
Yep.
And Josh, you're going to?
Soccer, Dad. Soccer practice.
Right. Oh, by the way, I just wanted to let you know when I pick you both up, I'll be wearing my short shorts.
What?
No!
Yep, and my dorky dad hat, and I'm gonna do my dad dance for all your friends. They'll love it!
Seriously? Why?
Because I like my short shorts. Of course, I could be talked out of it if you guys would just buckle up your seatbelts without giving me a hard time.
It's important to get your kids to buckle up for safety, no matter what it takes. And sometimes, all it takes is your parental powers of persuasion.
Okay, we're buckling up.
See, all buckled.
Good choice. I'll just have to do my dad dance at dinner time.
What?
No!
Do what you have to make sure your kids are wearing their seatbelts, even on short drives. Never give up until they buckle up. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council. Visit safercar.gov/kidsbuckleup for more information.
You know, I often wondered what makes people tick. And then I signed up for classes at Henry Ford College and found out that studying human behavior can be a fascinating field to work in. Starting your education in this field can begin right here at Henry Ford College. For those who wish to pursue a career, advance a degree in a subject, or maybe just want to try something new, Henry Ford College has courses to fit a variety of needs. The social sciences include all the disciplines dedicated to the scientific understanding of human behavior. Social scientists study the patterns of the ways people think, act, and react as individuals and as members of society. Does this sound interesting to you? It did to me. The Henry Ford College Humanities and Social Science Division offers a wide variety of associate degree and certificate programs. To find out more, call the division office at 313-845-9625, or you can visit them on the web at hfcc.edu. The studying of human behavior, a fascinating field to work in and a career that can begin right here at Henry Ford College.
Welcome back. This is the new WHFR Journal here on the station Making Waves, WHFR 89.3 FM in Dearborn, Detroit, also online at WHFR.FM. And yes, I fully admit, as Susan alluded to, that I'm, what's the correct phrase, bronchially challenged or pneumatically challenged this week, while the rest of us have all been, the rest of you have all been enjoying being outdoors. Enjoying the great weather. It has been a beautiful week, and finally we can start to think about planting flowers and getting our gardens going. I know that this weekend is Flower Day over at Eastern Market. So for our next segment, I thought we would turn to a TED Talk, which talks about bees. Bees, which are an essential creature that makes all of our gardens and much of our agriculture work. This comes from Marla Spivak, who is a bee scholar. She researches bees' behavior and biology in an effort to preserve this threatened but ecologically essential insect. It should be no big surprise for many gardeners and horticulturists and even those who grow vegetable gardens and farm for a living that bees have been a threatened species over the past few years. So we thought we would listen to this TED Talk in honor of spring and a planting season. Don't forget Flower Day at Eastern Market coming up this weekend. I think it's finally safe to plant those annuals. It's been a long time coming, but I think the soil's finally ready for it. Anyway, we thought we would take a listen to this TED Talk about why bees are disappearing here on the new WHFR Journal.
This is our life with bees. And this is our life without bees. Bees are the most important pollinators of our fruits and vegetables and flowers and crops like alfalfa hay that feed our farm animals. More than one-third of the world's crop production is dependent on bee pollination. But the ironic thing is that bees are not out there pollinating our food intentionally. They're out there because they need to eat. Bees get all of the protein they need in their diet from pollen and all of the carbohydrates they need from nectar. They're flower feeders. And as they move from flower to flower, basically on a shopping trip at the local floral mart, they end up providing this valuable pollination service. In parts of the world where there are no bees or where they plant varieties that are not attractive to bees, people are paid to do the business of pollination by hand. These people are moving pollen from flower to flower with a paintbrush. Now, this business of hand pollination is actually not that uncommon. Tomato growers often pollinate their tomato flowers with a handheld vibrator. Now, this one's the tomato tickler. Now, this is because the pollen within a tomato flower is held very securely within the male part of the flower, the anther. And the only way to release this pollen is to vibrate it. So bumblebees are one of the few kinds of bees in the world that are able to hold on to the flower and vibrate it. And they do this by shaking their flight muscles at a frequency similar to the musical note C. So they vibrate the flower, they sonicate it, and that releases the pollen in this efficient swoosh, and the pollen gathers all over the fuzzy bee's body, and she takes it home as food. Tomato growers now put bumblebee colonies inside the greenhouse to pollinate the tomatoes because they get much more efficient pollination when it's done naturally, and they get better quality tomatoes. So there's other, maybe more personal reasons to care about bees. There's over 20,000 species of bees in the world, and they're absolutely gorgeous. These bees spend the majority of their life cycle hidden in the ground or within a hollow stem, and very few of these beautiful species have evolved highly social behavior, like honeybees. Now, honeybees tend to be the charismatic representative for the other 19,900 plus species because there's something about honeybees that draws people into their world. Humans have been drawn to honeybees since early recorded history, mostly to harvest their honey, which is an amazing natural sweetener. I got drawn into the honeybee world completely by a fluke. I was 18 years old and bored, and I picked up a book at the library on bees, and I spent the night reading it. I had never thought about insects living in complex societies. It was like the best of science fiction come true. And even stranger, there were these people, these beekeepers, that loved their bees like they were family. And when I put down the book, I knew I had to see this for myself. So I went to work for a commercial beekeeper, a family that owned 2,000 hives of bees in New Mexico. And I was permanently hooked. Honeybees can be considered a superorganism, where the colony is the organism, and it's comprised of 40 to 50,000 individual bee organisms. Now, this society has no central authority. Nobody's in charge. So how they come to collective decisions and how they allocate their tasks and divide their labor, how they communicate where the flowers are, all of their collective social behaviors are mind-blowing. My personal favorite, one that I've studied for many years, is their system of health care. So bees have social health care. So in my lab, we study how bees keep themselves healthy. For example, we study hygiene, where some bees are able to locate and weed out sick individuals from the nest, from the colony, and keeps the colony healthy. And more recently, we've been studying resins that bees collect from plants. So bees fly to some plants and they scrape these very, very sticky resins off the leaves, and they take them back to the nest where they cement them into the nest architecture, where we call it propolis. We found that propolis is a natural disinfectant. It's a natural antibiotic. It kills off bacteria and molds and other germs within the colony, and so it bolsters the colony health and their social immunity. Humans have known about the power of propolis since biblical times. We've been harvesting propolis out of bee colonies for human medicine, but we didn't know how good it was for the bees. So honeybees have these remarkable natural defenses that have kept them healthy and thriving for over 50 million years. So 7 years ago, when honeybee colonies were reported to be dying en masse, first in the United States, it was clear that there was something really, really wrong. In our collective conscience, in a really primal way, we know we can't afford to lose bees. So what's going on? Bees are dying from multiple and interacting causes, and I'll go through each of these. The bottom line is, bees dying reflects a flowerless landscape and a dysfunctional food system. Now, we have the best data on honeybees, so I'll use them as an example. In the United States, bees, in fact, have been in decline since World War II. We have half the number of managed hives in the United States now compared to 1945. We're down to about 2 million hives of bees, we think. And the reason is, after World War II, we changed our farming practices. We stopped planting cover crops. We stopped planting clover and alfalfa, which are natural fertilizers that fix nitrogen in the soil. And instead, we started using synthetic fertilizers. Clover and alfalfa are highly nutritious food plants for bees. And after World War II, we started using herbicides to kill off the weeds in our farms. Many of these weeds are flowering plants that bees require for their survival. And we started growing larger and larger crop monocultures. Now, we talk about food deserts, places in our cities, neighborhoods that have no grocery stores. The very farms that used to sustain bees are now agricultural food deserts dominated by one or two plant species like corn and soybeans. Since World War II, we have been systematically eliminating many of the flowering plants that bees need for their survival. And these monocultures extend even to crops that are good for bees, like almonds. 50 years ago, beekeepers would take a few colonies, hives of bees, into the almond orchards for pollination, and also because the pollen in an almond blossom is really high in protein. It's really good for bees. Now, the scale of almond monoculture demands that most of our nation's bees, over 1.5 million hives of bees, be transported across the nation to pollinate this one crop. And they're trucked in semi-loads, and they must be trucked out because after bloom, the almond orchards are a vast and flowerless landscape. Bees have been dying over the last 50 years, and we're planting more crops that need them. There has been a 300% increase in crop production that requires bee pollination. And then there's pesticides. After World War II, we started using pesticides on a large scale, and this became necessary because of the monocultures that put out a feast for crop pests. Recently, researchers from Penn State University have started looking at the pesticide residue in the loads of pollen that bees carry home as food. And they found that every batch of pollen that a honeybee collects has at least 6 detectable pesticides in it. And this includes every class of insecticides, herbicides, fungicides, and even an inert and unlabeled ingredients that are part of the pesticide formulation that can be more toxic than the active ingredient. This small bee is holding up a large mirror. How much is it going to take to contaminate humans? One of these class of insecticides, the neonicotinoids, is making headlines around the world right now. You've probably heard about it. This is a new class of insecticides. It moves through the plant so that a crop pest, a leaf-eating insect, would take a bite of the plant and get a lethal dose and die. If one of these neonics, we call them, is applied in a high concentration, such as in this ground application, enough of the compound moves through the plant and gets into the pollen and the nectar, where a bee can consume, in this case, a high dose of this neurotoxin that makes the bee twitch and die. In most agricultural settings, on most of our farms, it's only the seed that's coated with the insecticide. And so a smaller concentration moves through the plant and gets into the pollen and nectar. And if a bee consumes this lower dose, either nothing happens or the bee becomes intoxicated and disoriented, and she may not find her way home. And on top of everything else, bees have their own set of diseases and parasites. Public enemy number one for bees is this thing. It's called Varroa destructor. It's aptly named. It's this big blood-sucking parasite that compromises the bee's immune system and circulates viruses. Let me put this all together for you. I don't know what it feels like to a bee to have a big blood-sucking parasite running around on it, and I don't know what it feels like to a bee to have a virus. But I do know what it feels like when I have a virus, the flu. And I know how difficult it is for me to get to the grocery store to get good nutrition. But what if I lived in a food desert? And what if I had to travel a long distance to get to the grocery store, and I finally got my weak body out there, and I consumed in my food enough of a pesticide, a neurotoxin, that I couldn't find my way home? And this is what we mean by multiple and interacting causes of death. And it's not just our honeybees. All of our beautiful wild species of bees are at risk, including those tomato-pollinating bumblebees. These bees are providing backup for our honeybees. They're providing the pollination insurance alongside our honeybees. We need all of our bees. So what are we going to do? What are we going to do about this big bee bummer that we've created? It turns out it's hopeful. It's hopeful. Every one of you out there can help bees in 2 very direct and easy ways. Plant bee-friendly flowers, and don't contaminate these flowers, this bee food, with pesticides. So go online and search for flowers that are native to your area and plant them. Plant them in a pot on your doorstep. Plant them in your front yard, in your lawns, in your boulevards. campaign to have them planted in public gardens, community spaces, meadows, set aside farmland. We need a beautiful diversity of flowers that blooms over the entire growing season from spring to fall. We need roadsides seeded in flowers for our bees, but also for migrating butterflies and birds and other wildlife. And we need to think carefully about putting back in cover crops to nourish our soil and nourish our bees. And we need to diversify our farms. We need to plant flowering crop borders and hedgerows to disrupt the agricultural food desert and begin to correct the dysfunctional food system that we've created. So maybe it seems like a really small countermeasure to a big, huge problem, just go plant flowers. But when bees have access to good nutrition, we have access to good nutrition through their pollination services. And when bees have access to good nutrition, they're better able to engage their own natural defenses, their health care that they've relied on for millions of years. So the beauty of helping bees this way for me is that every one of us needs to behave a little bit more like a bee society, an insect society, where each of our individual actions can contribute to a grand solution, an emergent property that's much greater than the mere sum of our individual actions. So let the small act of planting flowers and keeping them free of pesticides be the driver of large-scale change. On behalf of the bees, thank you.
Thank you. Just a quick question. The latest numbers on the die-off of bees, is there any sign of things bottoming out? What's your hope/depression level on this?
Yeah, at least in the United States, an average of 30% of all beehives are lost every winter. About 20 years ago, we were at a 15% loss. So it's getting precarious.
That's not 30% a year. That's 30%.
Yes, 30% a year. 30%
a year.
But then beekeepers are able to divide their colonies, and so they can maintain the same number. They can recuperate some of their loss. We're kind of at a tipping point. We can't really afford to lose that many more. We need to be really appreciative of all the beekeepers out there.
Thank you. Thank you.
Marla Spivak and her TED Talk on why bees are disappearing here on the new WHFR Journal. We hope that since this TED Talk was given back in, 2013, that the bee colonies have started to recover. She gives some hope for the future. I know that it's still a bit of an uphill climb for many of the bee colonists out there, but hopefully things will look better for the future. We look forward to a great and productive spring for many of our bee colonies. They are essential, and we certainly depend on them, not only to make our lives beautiful in terms of our garden, but also for our vegetable gardens and for farming and all of the fruits and vegetables that we enjoy. This is the new WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, trying to bring it through to a finish. As Susan McGraw alluded to earlier in the program, not been a great week for me, but one way or the other, we're going to get you through to 2 o'clock when Kitty Love comes in to take us on a trip down Highway 61. Anyway, in addition to a flower day at Eastern Market, which takes place this weekend, we also began Ramadan earlier this weekend, and obviously an important event and month of the year for many in our community. So we thought we would turn to a TED Talk that also deals with Ramadan, this one being coming from Basim Tariq, who is a blogger, a filmmaker, a halal butcher, and talks about his trip of 30 mosques in 30 days in a TED Talk called The Beauty and Diversity of Muslim Life. Enjoy it here on the new WHFR Journal.
I'm a blogger, filmmaker, and a butcher. and I'll explain how these identities come together. It started 4 years ago when a friend and I opened our first Ramadan fast at one of the busiest mosques in New York City. Crowds of men with beards and skull caps were swarming the streets. It was an FBI agent's wet dream. But being a part of this community, we knew how welcoming the space was. For years, I'd seen photos of this space being documented as a lifeless and cold monolith, much like the stereotypical image painted of the American Muslim experience. Frustrated by this myopic view, my friend and I had this crazy idea. Let's break our fast at a different mosque in a different state each night of Ramadan and share those stories on a blog. We called it 30 Mosques in 30 Days. And we drove to all the 50 states and shared stories from over 100 vastly different Muslim communities, ranging from the Cambodian refugees in the LA projects to the black Sufis living in the woods of South Carolina. What emerged was a beautiful and complicated portrait of America. The media coverage forced local journalists to revisit their Muslim communities. But what was really exciting was seeing people from around the world being inspired to take their own 30 Mosques journey. There were even these two NFL athletes that took a sabbatical from the league to do so. And as 30 Mosques was blossoming around the world, I was actually stuck in Pakistan working on a film. My co-director Umar and I were at a breaking point with many of our friends on how to position the film. The movie is called These Birds Walk, and it is about wayward street kids who are struggling to find some semblance of family. We focus on the complexities of youth and family discord, but our friends kept on nudging us to comment on drones and target killings to make the film more relevant, essentially reducing these people who've entrusted us with their stories into socio-political symbols. Of course, we didn't listen to them, and instead, we championed the tender gestures of love and headlong flashes of youth. The agenda behind our cinematic immersion was only empathy, an emotion that's largely deficient from films that come from our region of the world. And as These Birds Walk played at film festivals and theaters internationally, I finally had my feet planted at home in New York. And with all the extra time and still no real money, my wife tasked me to cook more for us. And whenever I go to the local butcher to purchase some halal meat, something felt off. For those that don't know, halal is a term used for meat that is raised and slaughtered humanely following very strict Islamic guidelines. Unfortunately, the majority of halal meat in America doesn't rise to the standard that my faith calls for. The more I learned about these unethical practices, the more violated I felt, particularly because businesses from my own community were the ones taking advantage of my orthodoxy. So, with emotions running high and absolutely no experience in butchery, some friends and I opened a meat store in the heart of the East Village Fashion District. We call it Honest Chops, and we're reclaiming halal by sourcing organic, humanely raised animals and by making it accessible and affordable to working class families. There's really nothing like it in America. The unbelievable part is actually that 90% of our in-store customers are not even Muslim. For many, it is their first time interacting with Islam on such an intimate level. So all these disparate projects are the result of a restlessness. They are a visceral response to the businesses and curators who work hard to oversimplify my beliefs and my community. And the only way to beat their machine is to play by different rules. We must fight with an inventive approach. With the trust, with the access, with the love that only we can bring, we must unapologetically reclaim our beliefs in every moving image, in every cut of meat. Because if we whitewash our stories for the sake of mass appeal, not only will we fail, but we will be trumped by those with more money and more resources to tell our stories. But the call for creative courage is not for novelty or relevance. It is simply because our communities are so damn unique and so damn beautiful. They demand us to find uncompromising ways to be acknowledged and respected. Thank you.
Bassam Tariq here on the new WHFR Journal and his TED Talk entitled The Beauty and Diversity of Muslim Life, which comes from a TED Global conference in October of 2014. He's also an author and a blogger, which dealt with his tour of 30 mosques in 30 days. and also a filmmaker with a film called These Birds Walk, and also a halal butcher in New York City. I'm Alan Mazurek. Thanks for being with us for the new WHFR Journal this week. Susan McGraw and I will be back next Friday afternoon and start to wrap things up for a little bit of a summer break for the new WHFR Journal. We thank you so much for being with us. We know that we've got lots of great stories and things to tell ahead, so do stick with us. Nonetheless, we do have also lots of great music here on WHFR, and it's going to begin in just a few minutes as we take a trip down Highway 61. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.
Zika is still a threat, and its effect on an unborn child can be devastating. So we're taking our doctor's advice on how to protect our unborn baby from Zika birth defects.
Mosquitoes can spread Zika, so wear insect repellent, long sleeve shirts, and long pants. Dump standing water and use window screens or AC. To prevent Zika spread from sex, use condoms, especially while pregnant.
I'm not taking a chance with Zika.
Let's keep stopping Zika. Visit cdc.gov/preventzika. This message from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hey, y'all, this is your favorite DJ, DJ Show, and I'm here with DJ Mo, and this is Soundtrack City. Our show airs every Wednesday at 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., so come visit us in Soundtrack City, and oh yeah, whatever happens in Soundtrack City stays in Soundtrack City.
HFC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology includes detailed instruction related to the various systems found on today's vehicles. This program is designed to provide students with a thorough knowledge of the technical aspects of the automobile and to develop a certain level of manual skill in servicing, testing, and diagnosing. Classroom and laboratory classes provide students with the experience and understanding they'll need to qualify in numerous fields of employment associated with the automobile industry. For more information on HFC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology, contact instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350. That's instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
Do you enjoy music? There's indie rock. How about some blues?
I grew up in Troy, Michigan, but I got my soul in Detroit, home of the hook, man.
Or maybe jazz. Something a little more simple, like singer-songwriter folk Americana. Or something harder, like metal. Hi, I am Scott Boatwright. Tune in every Thursday for all these different genres of music from local artists, live performances every week from 5 to 6 p.m., interviews, and a vinyl showcase at 6 where I play an album in its entirety. That's every Thursday, live from Studio J.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Highway 61.